4 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dylan Williams from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind everyone in the committee and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. The first item on our agenda today is House Bill 29, Insurance Discrimination, sponsored by Representative McCabe. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative McCabe and his staff, Julie Morris. If you would both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you can begin your presentation. And then now Senator Giesel has other committee calls, and she probably won't last long, but thank you for coming to help us make a quorum.
Good afternoon, Chair Klayman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 29. For the record, I'm Kevin McCabe, representative for House District 30. With me, I have my staff, Julie Morris, here at the table. So for a bill introduction, insurance companies are in the business of discrimination. Insurers segregate the insured into separate risk pools based on the differences in risk profiles for two main reasons. So they can charge different premiums to the different groups based on their risk and to incentivize risk reduction by the insured. So think of the difference that car insurance you have if you have a teenager in your household, or also if you put one of the dongles in your car that monitors your driving habits. Those are the sort of the outliers of the way they separate risk. There are, however, limits to the type of discrimination that insurers can engage in. Those discrimination restriction decisions are decided at the national and at the local levels of government, and laws on discrimination and intensity of regulation vary a great deal in each jurisdiction. Insurance companies have been denying coverage to Alaskans based solely on their political affiliation, expression, and/or elected status. This bill aims to put an end to such discriminatory practices. Through amendment in Senate Judiciary, we've also added a member of the state's congressional delegation, expanding the scope of protection to encompass all aspects summarized as the person's status as an elected official. And I'm not sure if Senate Judiciary is correct.
I think that must have been House Judiciary.
Because House Judiciary,
yeah, I'm sorry. Our first hearing, I think the odds we added, right. Yeah. Although we like to think of ourselves as all-powerful.
Specifically, House Bill 29 amends the insurance code in Alaska from using a person's status as an elected official as the sole reason to refuse to insure or refuse to renew insurance coverage, limit the scope of insurance coverage, cancel an existing insurance policy, deny a claim covered by an existing insurance policy, or increase the premium policy fees or rates charged on an insurance policy. Specifically, I want to emphasize at this point, this bill would not prohibit refusals, limitations, or fees that are based on sound underwriting or actuarial principles. Given that insurance products are necessary to protecting our health and property, in some instances even required by law, I believe that it is in the public interest to ensure that consumers are protected from discriminatory practices. And I believe that House Bill 29 helps in that effort. So, Senator, as you and I have talked, this was born because I was denied an umbrella policy. I had been shopping for an umbrella policy and was working on getting one, and then also working on getting elected. And when I mentioned to the insurance salesman that I had just recently been elected to the legislature, he said, "Well, then I can't offer you this policy." And I said, "Not even at a greater price range?" He said, "Absolutely not." So when I get down here, I put this bill in. And you know, specifically, within a month or so, and got discussions with the director of insurance for the state. And she actually called and talked to several, if not all of her insurance policy providers in the state and found out that, yes, it is true. If you're an elected official from a school board all the way on up to our congressional delegation in D.C., many companies won't offer you an umbrella policy at any rate, not even an increase. So this bill sort of takes on an increasing relevancy in that respect after doing even more investigations. So with that, Ms. Morris is available to read the sectional if you'd like, or I'm available for questions.
You want to go through the sectional analysis, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Chairman Klayman and members of the Judiciary Committee. Julie Morris, staff to Representative McCabe, and I will go over. It's just two short sections.
I note Senator Keel joined us, the vice chair, at 229. Please proceed.
Section 1 amends 2136 to add a new section that prohibits a person transacting insurance in this state from discriminating against a person based solely on the person's political affiliation or expression or a person's status as an elected state official as defined in AS 4499-205. Section 2 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section regarding applicability and effective dates to insurance policies and or contracts. And there was some changes, an amendment that was in Labor and Commerce. If you wanted me to do that, I can.
Was that added in Labor and Commerce?
Yes, sir.
And are we looking at version U.A or a different version?
It would be in the new version of the bill.
Okay. I don't think we need to. If what's in Labor and Commerce is in the version that we have, then I think we're good.
So, Senator, Representative McCabe, yes, U.A, and it was, I said Senate Judiciary, it should have been Senate Labor and Commerce. They're the first that heard this bill over here. And they made the addition to put the congressional delegation in there.
So I think actually it must not be U.A, because I'm looking at U.A, and that doesn't have the part about the congressional delegation. So I'm sure the updated version does.
Okay.
Any questions for the... for Representative McCabe or his staff? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think the Y version is what came out of Senate Labor and Commerce, and I believe that does have the congressional delegation at page 2, line 6. And I apologize for being late. And if you've already covered this, just let me know. I can go back. Can you talk, does this apply to all insurance? Is this limited to property casualty? Is this limited to life, health, across the board?
So through the chair, Representative McCabe and Senator Keel, it would apply to all insurance. So if they offer, the idea behind the bill is if they offer a policy to the general public, they cannot exclude an elected official such as a school board. It doesn't matter what it is. An elected official such as a school board, a legislator, or a congressional delegation, just because they are an elected official. If there is a sound actuarial reason to exclude them or to charge them more, as long as it fits within what Director Winghire considers the normal parameters for that person. And you weren't here, but as I said, it's like an automobile policy. You're a 17-year-old teenager. You pay more because he's a new driver. And if you were to buy the dongle that goes in your cigarette lighter that tracks your movements and braking episodes and that kind of stuff, you could actually pay less. Those are all sound actuarial principles. But if they denied you coverage for a car because you were an elected official driving up and down the hills in Juneau or whatever, then that would not be correct. It would
follow up. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate and agree with the no denials provision. I note that the bill, I think, also prohibits higher premiums or fees or rates. And I guess what I... just speculating, we'll go with a hypothetical. If an insurance company said, it turns out that all the elected officials in Alaska have terribly high blood pressure as a result of having to deal with Keel's stupid questions, and we're seeing increased health costs, would that be forbidden by this bill because it is directly tied to being an elected official, even though I've just sent people to the hospital with all these annoying questions.
No, Senator Keel, Representative McCabe, and through the chair, no, because if it's based on sound underwriting or actuarial principles, if they can determine that a legislature or a legislator is at increased health risk because all we do is sit around and talk all day, if they can prove that, if they go to Director Winghire and say, hey, we have to jack his rates up because this is what we're seeing, and they have volumes of books with their discs or data on sound actuarial principles. What I don't believe they have is a basis to say you can't have this insurance merely because you are elected. And you missed the intro. This was what happened to me. I was shopping for an umbrella policy in the summer before I got elected, and I was running for office. I got elected in November, trying to finalize everything before I came down here. I called the insurance company, said I'm ready to pull the trigger. And I happened to mention to the guy, because I was kind of proud, that I had just been elected, and he said, sorry, can't offer it to you. I said, not at all. He said, I cannot offer you this insurance policy as an elected official. Not at any price, no, sir. So that's what sort of drove this bill. And the more that Director Winghire looked into it, the more she found that there was a reason for the bill itself and possibly that it was needed. So.
No, Mr. Chairman, it's got me cogitating on whether we need to let the director look into underwriting in more places rather than just rate making. But I'll leave that off this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I think I've got only one query. So another perspective on the situation of the umbrella policy with passage of this bill. If they could show that elected officials get more claims against them and their umbrella policies get hit, you could discover that with somebody other than the elected official status that lives in a similar situation and has a similar economic and other picture as you do, they could charge you a higher premium because you're an elected official, but they couldn't deny you coverage entirely.
That's correct.
I don't have any other questions, and I don't see any other questions, so we're going to go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 29. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 29? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to look online. I don't see anyone online for public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony. So for further review, I would note that if you do have amendments on this bill, please have them to our office by, let's say, noon on Monday next week. And with that, we'll hold the bill. That will be Monday, the 6th of May. And our last item on our agenda today is House Bill 97, Self-Storage Units, Lien Sales, sponsored by Representative Prox. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative Prox and his staff, Maggie Elliott. Please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and you can begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the records, I'm Representative Mike Prox, House District 33. And we're talking about storage liens. Storage liens, self-storage liens, are the national standard for settling disputes between facility owners and unit renters. These laws provide protection for both unit renters and storage facility owners in the event rent is not paid and contents of a storage unit are abandoned. Alaska is the last remaining state without a self-storage lien law. Because of this, we have inconsistent industry standards among self-storage facilities that creates confusion for facility owners and tenants. Facility owners have been using contract templates from other states and sometimes base them on archaic laws that were meant for common carriers, warehouses, and agassists, which are folks that I didn't know about, that rent their fields to graze animals. So In states with self-storage lien laws, there are clear statutory standards and procedures for handling delinquent tenants. The absence of such laws in Alaska makes it harder for customers to understand their rights and obligations. And self-storage facility owners in Alaska face legal challenges when dealing with delinquent tenants. The absence of clear regulatory guidelines on how to handle non-payment and abandoned storage units makes it difficult to recover unpaid rent, evict tenants, or properly dispose of abandoned items and get their units available for the next person to rent. HB 97 provides a process for addressing situations in which a self-storage unit renter fails to pay their rent or otherwise abandons their unit, and the facility owner must sell the renter's property to recover the debt and get the unit back into service. National data from Self-Storage Association indicates that facility owners only sell approximately 1-3% of leased spaces annually. It's an infrequently used procedure, but it is necessary for the successful operation of the storage facility. Many of the lien sales involve unit renters who have abandoned the unit after removing their valuable property. They're not interested in collecting what's left over, packaging materials, and etc., and cleaning up the unit. They just leave without paying the next month's rent, and that's when the facility owner gets alerted to the situation. HB 97 would require facility owners to include specific information regarding the facility owner's lien rights in the rental agreement, and that's the lease that governs the relationship between the two parties. HB 97 would also require the facility owner to send a default notice to the unit renter before a lien enforcement can begin. If the unit renter does not cure the default, the facility owner would then be required to send a second notice of default to the unit renter at least 10 days after the first notice. The second notice must provide an additional 20-day window for the unit renter to cure the default and pay the debt owed. After all of this, if the debt is not paid, then HB 97 would permit the facility owner to proceed with a sale of the abandoned items and recover the past due expenses. HB 97 details that process and how proceeds from that sale must be applied in a fair and equitable manner. And we have my staff assistant, Maggie Elliott, here to go through the highlights of the sectional if you would like. And we're prepared to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
If you want to go ahead and present your sectional analysis, and then we will take up questions.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Maggie Elliott, staff to Representative Prox. I will now read the highlights of the sectional for House Bill 97. Subsection 1, which applies to abandoned vehicles, and subsection 2, which applies to carriers and warehouses and livestock liens, is conforming language. Subsection 3 adds a new section titled Article 13A, Self-Storage Facilities. Section 3435-600. This section details that a facility owner has a storage lien on unit property if the unit renter fails to abide by a written rental agreement, including paying the rental charges and reasonable late fees. Section 605, priority of storage lien. A storage lien is superior to a lien or encumbrance established under AS 2810-371. Section B, a storage lien is superior to a security interest perfected under AS 4529. A storage lien is also superior to another lien or security lien except a tax lien. Section 610, a storage lien attaches on the day property is placed in storage, must contain a statement notifying the unit renter of the existence of the storage lien and the method by which the facility owner may enforce the lien. Section 615 gives facility owners the right to enforce a storage lien after a unit renter has been continuously in default for at least 10 days. Section 620, denial of access, removal of unit property. The section also allows the facility owner to tow or otherwise remove a vehicle or watercraft from the storage facility. Section 625 requires the facility owner to notify the unit renter and any lien holders identified in the rental agreement that a unit renter is in default before enforcing a storage lien. Section 630, authority to dispose of unit property. 635 section, sale and disposal of unit property. Section B allows the facility owner to privately sell, give away, donate, or throw away unit property that is not commercially viable to dispose of by a public sale. And last but not least, Section 34, 35, 640, Section A, states before the sale of the property, the unit renter may redeem the unit property by paying the amount due, in which case the facility owner shall immediately return the unit property to the unit renter. Section B states that if the vehicle owner of record or a lien holder pays the amount due before the facility owner disposes of the vehicle under AS 34, 35, 635, the facility owner shall transfer possession of the vehicle to the vehicle owner or lien holder who pays the amount due. Thank you.
Questions from, and we do have some folks for invited testimony. Questions from the committee? I have two questions. First is, I'm looking at section 34, 35, 665, additional rights and obligations. And as I read that section, that looks like if we pass this legislation and I own a storage facility and I have contracts that everybody that's renting in the storage unit have signed my contract and my contract conflicts with this new law, what's in control, the contract that they've signed, or does this law supersede the contract I entered into with my tenants?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have an existing contact today, and when this goes in effect, what happens?
Yes.
Well, good question, but I would assume that the existing contract continues on, that the new contract wouldn't take effect unless they signed a new rental agreement.
Well, I'm just reading on line 18. It says, do not prevent a rental agreement from containing other rights, duties, and obligations that do not conflict with or arise from this, you know, the sections that we're enacting here. And that appears to me to suggest that this law would super, if to the extent this law has conflicting provisions, the law would control and not the contract.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prox, Could you repeat the section so I can get on the same page?
It's section 34, 35, 665. It's line page 5, lines 16 through 20. Additional rights and obligations.
Page
5.
Line 20.
Line 16 through 20.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prox, I am not reading that and thinking about it the same way, in that do not prevent a rental agreement from obtaining other rights duties that do not conflict with these new sections.
You can think about that. Unfortunately, you're on time limited today. I know you've got some invited testimony that
they might be able to address that. Yep.
And then the second question that I have is, there's been some reference about a motor vehicle that is in a storage unit, And let's just say that it's a really nice, valuable car, and it's got a $30,000 loan on the car, and that's the bank. It's with a bank. It's just a regular, everyday car loan, and the bank is listed as the first lien holder on the car. And somebody leaves. Who's in first position, the bank or the storage unit?
Now I have to think about the original or the amended. We'll debate that. The original concept was that the storage facility owner has the superior lien, the first right, and that is kind of modeled after the warehouseman, transportation, and agassists, in that in those situations you're dealing with more valuable property, and the facility owner, in this case the warehouse, has a superior lien on other liens that might be available. And this, the HB 97 requires notification of the lien holder before any sale, and they have a right to that. But as I recall it now, and I'm sorry, I'm thinking about Nurse Lysinger compacts right now.
Okay.
But let's assume, and we'll debate that if we need to, let's assume that the bill has the facility owner has a superior position on the lien.
And you think that's what the legislation does now?
I would have to check to confirm.
Why not? This is a second question. You can get back.
Yes.
On that question. Mm-hmm. But those are two questions I have. That's prompting other questions. Senator Tobin, you get first.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just hopefully going to help provide an answer to your questions. Actually, on page 2, the section starts on 10 to line 15, and it says property of storage lien.
Priority of storage lien.
Oh, excuse me, priority. Sorry. Thank you.
So that your second section, because I was actually looking on page 4 about redemption. It's lines 21 through 24 about where the vehicle owner sits, and you're, Senator Tobin, you're saying section 6.605 puts the bank in first place.
Yes. I stand corrected.
Okay. All
the
right.
Stands corrected too.
Anything else, Senator Tobin? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess two questions. The first, since we're on page 2, maybe I'll just stick there for a minute. Or at the top of page 2, so I guess it's the bottom of 1 to 2. The lien is general lien is limited to the unpaid rent for 60 days. Does that have the consequence of almost requiring a self-storage owner to cut the lock off earlier than they otherwise might? Sometimes commercial storage folks will carry somebody for 3 or 4 months in the winter when they're not getting fishing income. Does capping the lien amount at 60 days of accrued charges maybe almost force them to shorten that?
It is a, excuse me, through the chair to Senator Keel. This is Representative Prox. It sets a minimum. It sets a maximum amount that they can charge. What the other parts of the bill gives the facility owner permission to cut the lock off the unit and determine what's inside of it. And if there is nothing of value to recoup, which is usually the case, it just needs cleanup and take the packaging materials out, then that sort of ends the process. There's nothing in it for the renter, so there's no need to carry on. So that's why we want it. That's the primary reason that we want to make the changes to enable self-storage unit owners to cut the lock off, see what's in there, and see whether they can just clean it up and get it back in to make it available for the next renter. There was a concern that they would be dawdling, if you will. So the charges, you can't continue to impose charges on somebody for rental after 60 days.
Okay. And Senator, we have two people here for invited testimony.
Okay.
I'm happy if you'd like to ask one more question, but I have this idea that we should hear the invited testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I will hold off so that the public can speak.
Okay. So we've got a couple of folks invited testimony requested by the bill sponsor. First, we've got Nathaniel Dye from Juno Self Storage. Mr. Dye, can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, if you want to provide your invited testimony, I'd ask you to make it not super long because we may have some questions and we have some time limits on our activities today.
Sure. Thank you for your time. Through the chair, I've been operating in self-storage in Alaska for a little over 10 years now, and I am excited that we finally have a chance at possibly getting a lien law passed in Alaska and look forward to a time when we are not the only state that doesn't regulate this industry. Daniel Bryant, the attorney with SSA, has done a wonderful job of working through this and providing lots of comments, and I would direct you to his statements that he's made in the record previously for detailed analysis. I'm happy to answer some questions at this time, or I did take some notes on the questions that have already been asked.
Do any committee members have questions? I don't see any from the other members of the committee. I have a question. So do you operate Juno Self Storage that has actually rented to some legislators, including me, from time to time?
I do.
Okay. So this is my question. Every self-storage unit that I've ever rented something for always has a contract that we sign, and you all have a contract that all your tenants sign. Why are you interested in having a state law that supersedes your contract, which in part this appears to do, and why would you want the state law that rather than just have everything being managed by the contracts that you enter into with your tenants?
Yes, I think in a perfect world, we would be self-managing, but we live in a litigious society and there's always a potential for risk. So having a state statute that, as we hope, sets the minimum requirements, and so every operator could then set their own standards above the minimum, I think preserves that ability for operators to decide what fits them, but also gives the protection to consumers and operators to know the bare minimum set of rules.
And would this legislation, if we pass it, require you to modify your contracts in any way?
Potentially. The attorney that I use to draft our storage lease also works with other operators in the state of Alaska, and he's reserved an opinion on how to move forward once he's seen the final version. But it could facilitate the need to provide addendums to every tenant and have an updated executed agreement, and it may not, depending on the final language.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions from the committee? Next person we have on, thank you very much, Mr. Dye, and appreciate the service you provided. I'm not renting from you now, but I think I rented from you for several years and always appreciated the good service. Next, for invited testimony, have Wendy McNaughton. Ms. McNaughton, if you want to provide your brief invited testimony, we'll see if we have questions.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Wendy McNaughton. I am one of the owners of Blue Moose Storage in Fairbanks. First, thank you for considering House Bill 97. As a self-storage owner in the state, this bill is important to me because it brings a defined legal structure, the lien enforcement process, when a customer goes into default. And currently, there is no legal framework in place. Clear and transparent guidelines are the key to mitigating risk for our business and protecting us. We are good local Alaskans running a small business to support our families. The last thing we want to do is foreclose on a tenant. It's a lot of work and not profitable. We've been associated with Blue Moose for 20 years, and in our experience, nearly 100% of foreclosures result in a loss for our business. which does bring me to the one exception I have on this bill, the recent amendment that states that we only can collect 60 days worth of fees and foreclosures. Currently, as it stands at Blue Moose, we foreclose at 101 days past due. We send out our final notice at 90 days past due. We appreciate this bill provides a minimum and a structure, but we appreciate the flexibility that we have to be able to work with our customers for an extended period of time. This addition does limit our flexibility, and it would have us considering moving our foreclosure date from 90 days to 60 days. So with that amendment removed, we are very supportive of this bill. Also happy to answer any questions. Mr. Dye, I think, did a very good job of illustrating why we feel like it is important to have this bill in place. We do have a very, very good contract, but you just really never know what's going to hold up in the state of Alaska. So having that assurance, that legal structure, helps mitigate risk for us.
Okay. I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much for joining us today. I should ask before we go to public testimony, do the members here have any problems? We run a little late so we can get through public testimony today. Not, I think, four, if they all want to testify. Okay, we're going to extend through till we get through public testimony. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to turn to the folks online. The first, Elizabeth Mann, General Manager, Alaska Mini Storage. Ms. Mann, if you want to put yourself on the record, and we're limiting public testimony today to 2 minutes, and if you can go shorter, that'd be even better. Please identify yourself and please proceed.
Yes, sir. For the record, this is Elizabeth Mann. I'm the General Manager for Alaska Mini Storage in Fairbanks and in Wasilla. Myself and the owners are in favor of House Bill 97. We do not feel that House Bill 97 is challenging any of our existing policies or regulations outside of the incoming request from the credit unions. I'm sure that many of the owners and managers are getting a little disgruntled with that. In summary, without a lien law, storage in Alaska is subject to kind of a wild, wild west environment. HB 97 will hold storage facilities to a higher standard, and in turn, it'll gain us more respect from our communities. And that's all I have to add today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Only query I have is the owner of Blue Moose had made notes about the 60-day provision that's on page 2 of the bill. What's your perspective on the 60-day provision on page 2?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I really think that should be up to, you know, the owner of each storage facilities on, you know, how long they want to give these folks that go into lien status. But she's right. None of us ever really win. So, you know, if that's the outcome, that 60 days is all we have, then, you know, we'll kick people out at 60 days then, and we won't charge any more late fees, but we're not going to let them continue to be in there past 60 days and not charge them more fees.
If 60 days is too short, what's a reasonable in your perspective?
Right now we have a 120-day auction. You know, I've talked to other owners, and I'm kind of gathering that we are pretty lenient. And so we've already been thinking about cutting back to 90 days. But, you know, in the winter months when it's very cold and someone is living out of state and we can't get a hold of them for, you know, a couple months, and then once we do, you know, we kind of go back and forth with them and we really try to work out a deal. But in most cases, we are losing in any of these battles. But the fact that these credit unions are, you know, having any type of say on this is just very frustrating. I just don't think that's the place. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. Next in line, we've got Tim. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testifying. Next, Tim Sullivan. this, speaking of the credit unions, he's with the Credit Union League. Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Sullivan. I'm the president of the Alaska Credit Union League. We are a trade association that represents the 10 credit unions doing business in Alaska, nine of which are headquartered in Alaska. We have been working with the sponsor and the requesters of this legislation over the course of the last year or so to try and make some significant changes that we thought were important both to the credit unions and our members that would be in a situation where they would be foreclosed upon in a by a storage unit. Several of those changes were adopted, and we really appreciate the changes to Section 34, 35, 605A. That you, Mr. Chairman, that you had questioned whether a vehicle loaned by a bank or credit union would be superior over the debt owed to the credit union. That change does make the vehicle loan superior to the self-storage unit fees. Also appreciate the changes that were made into notification periods of time to make sure that both the owner of the vehicle and that the credit unions or whomever had the lien upon the vehicle would be notified in a timely manner. The only concern that we really have remaining is in Section 34, 35, 640B. It discusses that if a vehicle lien holder were wanting to get the vehicle out of storage, they would have to pay all of the debt that was owed on the self-storage unit in order to get it out, which kind of stands in conflict with the lien superiority for the vehicle lien holder that's in 34, 35, 605A. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much for taking the time to call in. Next in the queue is Sharon Beeman.
Sharon Beeman, your line is unmuted.
Hello, my name is Sharon Beeman. I'm the manager of Forbes Storage in North Pole. And I'd like to clarify a couple of questions that have already come up. This, the question of the vehicle auction. If we have, the Department of Motor Vehicles has rules about how we can auction a vehicle. So, some of the wording in this bill is in conflict with that flow chart that the Department of Motor Vehicles has. And I think I can speak for a lot of the storage facilities that have and store vehicles that we do contact the lien holder to find out if they want the vehicle and explain to them that we would like to have the fees paid, which more than likely they are happy to do in order to get their vehicle. But with that said, I think the committee really needs to look at the Department of Motor Vehicles regulations on how to auction a vehicle. Secondly, I agree with Ms. McNaughton about this new amendment that was put in and this unable to collect fees after the 60 days. That is going to shorten up our auction process time. And it is rare if we can even recoup the monthly fees that we have already lost. And we actually were hoping that this House bill would eliminate some of the fees that we have to incur bring everything into this century and do a lot of this through email, because that is something that people are consistent with, not necessarily an address, such as certified letters going out 2 and 3 times to make sure that they're notified and not just through regular mail.
Ms. Beeman, you're a little past the 2 minute mark. Can you conclude your remarks?
I apologize. And we're concerned about our advertising fees as well. Thank you for your time. Do you have any questions?
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you.
Next in the queue, we've got Daniel Fonov. Mr. Fonov, if you want to identify yourself and please proceed.
Yes, my name is Daniel Fonov. I am the site manager at Eagle Eyes Gear Storage in Wasilla. And I agree with most of the other managers that have also presented their opinions on this bill. Personally, I am a fan of it. I would really appreciate having this more state legal guidelines that we can follow and implement into our rental agreements in the case if it's ever examined in a courtroom. And rather than it being up to interpretation by a judge, which is what happens with some of our current laws that are, or the current rules that we implement in our rental agreements, because they can change depending on the facility, whatever they determine is best for their lien guidelines. So to have an Alaska state guideline that can follow, it eliminates that interpretation, and it just has a set guideline that would always need to be followed. So yeah, just overall, I'm a big fan of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much for joining us today. I don't see anyone else online to provide public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 97. And we're past our usual ending time, so we will hold this bill for further review. I would note on this bill as well that we'll set an amendment deadline for Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. And again, we'll hold it for further review, and we're going to adjourn for the day. And I just announced earlier the deadlines for amendments, and our next meeting is Monday, May 6th at 1:30 p.m. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is